Good afternoon. I think we'll get started. My name's Jennifer Cook. I'm co-director of the Africa program here at CSIS. We're delighted to have with us today Adekeye Adebajo to talk about the role of South Africa and Nigeria within Africa. Ade is the executive director of the Center for Conflict Resolution in Cape Town. He was previously director of the Africa program at the International Peace Academy in New York City, and meanwhile was an adjunct professor at Columbia University. He's been on UN missions in South Africa, Western Sahara, and Iraq, and is a long list of publications, which I won't go into. And clearly is still producing multiple publications per year, and is one of, I find, very provocative, interesting, and kind of fun speaker to listen to. Today we're talking about essentially two of his most recent publications, collections of edited essays on South Africa's role in Africa. This is this one. And Gulliver's Troubles, Nigeria's Foreign Policy After the Cold War, which is this one. Unfortunately, the wrong books were sent to us, so we have a lot of these African Union books also, which Ade edited, and they're in the back of the room as you go, but I think the pamphlet that I've handed around describes how you can get a hold of the other ones, and we'll be getting a number of the Nigeria books in, hopefully, later today. And if you're interested, just let me know and we can get them to you sometime here in Washington. I think the topic that Ade is addressing is a very important one as we rely more and more on African institutions, regional and continental institutions, the African Union, to take up responsibility within Africa on African conflicts and so forth. I think the big question is, who are the big power players within those institutions? South Africa and Nigeria have traditionally played that role, driving forward initiatives like the NEPAD and the African Renaissance and so forth. But both of those countries have been beset recently with internal problems. In Nigeria, a very flawed election, a new president who... at least to my mind, has been less focused on regional issues and much more consumed with dealing with Nigeria's internal problems. In South Africa, too, you have internal political developments, I think, that are eclipsing somewhat South Africa's regional role. The xenophobic attacks, which I think have undermined perhaps somewhat their ability to play that regional role. And then, and Ade may disagree, I think the loss of credibility in the failure to confront Zimbabwe and the regional crisis that's brewing right next door. I'm anxious to hear from Ade. And then with Ade today, as a discussant, is Ambassador Princeton Lyman. I think most of you are familiar with Princeton, former ambassador to both Nigeria and South Africa, so I can speak very well to these issues. Currently a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he's led the Africa program until just very recently, and a very thoughtful analyst who we call upon very frequently here at CSIS for his insight and wisdom. So, Ade, thank you for coming. We're delighted to have you here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, and good afternoon. Thank you all very much for making time to come. I know how valuable time is in the imperial capital of the world. We in Africa are looking forward very much to the end of the Bush administration and to the beginning of the first African in the White House. And we hope that Africa will actually humanize American foreign policy from January 2009. So what I intend to do, as has been said, and I was with, I have to say also, Jennifer and Princeton at Ditchley Park, which is a castle near Oxford, in March this year and really enjoyed the time there. It was a conference on South Africa in Africa, and Princeton was wondering when I was going to come back here. I spent a year at the Brookings Institution as a pre-doctoral fellow back in 96, so it's really good to be back here, and I'm glad both of you urged me to come back here. So two of the books on South Africa in Africa and Nigeria in Africa are going to be the focus of my discussion. And I thought I would just very briefly describe what these books try to do and place them in context. The South Africa in Africa is actually the first publication looking at South Africa's role in Africa over the last 13 or 14 years. The first section looks at the socioeconomic and political context and some of the domestic challenges facing South Africa. A second section looks at both traditional issues of leadership and also less traditional foreign policy issues like HIV/AIDS and land conflicts. And then a final section assesses South Africa's role in West, Southern, and North Africa, as well as the Great Lakes region, highlighting its role in the making of the AU and NEPAD. And it's edited by two Nigerians, myself and the far more eminent Adebayo Adedeji, with whom I'm sometimes confused, and also a South African, Chris Landsberg. The second book on Nigeria also tries to be one of the first comprehensive assessments of Nigeria's post-Cold War foreign policy, because there used to be a lot of books on Nigeria's foreign policy in the 60s and 70s. That's become something of a drought. And what we've done is gather together a group of mostly Nigerian authors, and also one of our authors, Gwendolyn Mickle, is here today with us. She wrote the Nigeria-US chapter, but we try to again assess the domestic challenges for Nigeria, look at the issue of Shell and the Niger Delta. We look then at some of the regional issues, including the relationship with South Africa, which I'm going to talk about today, and then we look at relations with key countries, the US, Britain, France, China, and then multilaterally with the UN, Commonwealth, and the EU. So at least you have some sense of what both books try to do. No prophet is honored in his own land. The biblical saying sums up the quandary that South Africa's Thabo Mbeki and Nigeria's Olusegun Obasanjo faced between 1999 and 2007. Both were criticized heavily for traveling abroad and not spending time on settling domestic issues. But both of them were also damaged, Mbeki by the HIV/AIDS legacy, I think less so on Zimbabwe, but we can discuss that, and Obasanjo by his tawdry efforts to seek a third term in April 2006. But both of them have to also be given credit for building many of the institutions like the African Union and NEPAD, and for peacemaking in Sierra Leone, Liberia, Burundi, and DRC. So that explains some of our Prophets of Africa's Renaissance with a big question mark title. A major issue of debate within and outside Africa has been whether South Africa and Nigeria could actually play the role of regional hegemons and make institutions like the AU and SADC in Southern Africa and ECOWAS in West Africa work better, as well as providing democratic governance in Africa. The reluctance of Western countries after the debacle in Somalia and Rwanda, which I'm sure you all remember in the 1990s, then resulted in questions about whether South Africa and Nigeria could fill the vacuum produced by the exit of external actors from Africa. Though South Africa accounts for about a third of Africa's economic strength and is wealthier than Nigeria, it faces military challenges and political rivals in its Southern African sub-region and more struggle for legitimacy than Nigeria does in West Africa. The apartheid-era army's destabilization of its neighbors has left a profound scar on Southern Africa and South Africa that even a black government will take decades to overcome. During the 1990s, Nigeria was more willing but unable to carry out swift and decisive military interventions in West Africa. South Africa was arguably more able but largely unwilling to undertake such military actions in Southern Africa as a result of the historical baggage that I just referred to. South Africa has military and economic capacity but lacks the legitimacy to play a hegemonic role. Nigeria has more legitimacy in its own sub-region, but lacks the military and economic capacity to act as an effective hegemon. So what I intend to do in the short time I have is to look at three different periods of the most strategic relationship in Africa between these two countries, who between them account for about 40% of sub-Saharan Africa's economic strength, have two of the strongest armies in Africa, and have played the most active role, I would argue, in the last decade and a half. The first period looks at the apartheid period between 1960 and 93, and we look at that under the subtitle of The Prophet and the Pariah. The second looks at the rule of General Abacha and Nelson Mandela between 94 and 98, and we look at that under King Babu and the Avuncular Saint. And the third looks at Mbeki and Obasanjo between 99 and 2007 under the philosopher king and the soldier farmer. The annus mirabilis of African independence in 1960 saw the birth of Nigeria amidst great hopes for a political and economic giant that was expected to take its preordained place in the African sun. Nigeria's leaders almost gave the impression that all the country had to do was simply appear on the African stage, and all other states will bow in deference at the splendor of the new African colossus that the gods had sent to fulfill their messianic mission in Africa. In the same year as Nigeria's independence, South Africa was about to be expelled from the Commonwealth for another bloody round of killings of unarmed blacks in Sharpeville during another ugly display of its atavistic policy of legally sanctioned racism. Many felt at the time that the apartheid state was heading towards civil war. And Pretoria's foreign policy, like Nigeria's, paradoxically, was also suffused with a missionary zeal, as apartheid's leaders talked patronizingly about their country having special responsibilities to spread Western values north of the Limpopo. It was, of course, a civilizing mission, but both African giants failed to achieve their leadership ambitions in Africa during this first period for very different reasons. In the case of Nigeria, its West African sub-region was littered with Francophone countries who basically looked to France, the self-appointed gendarme d'Afrique, for protection against a potential neighborhood bully. And the Gallic power, France, acted as a pyromaniac arsonist during this period, intervening about 30 times, changing regimes, shuffling around regimes like a deranged poker player, even flying in David Dacko into the Central African Republic after, it had tired of Bokassa in 1977. So Nigeria, thus, was unable to produce the common market through the economic community of West African states that it sought to produce as a way of reducing France's influence in West Africa. South Africa, in contrast, was able effortlessly to subdue its neighbors, both economically and militarily, through quite brutal means. $60 billion in damages resulted and nearly a million deaths in the 1980s alone as a result of South Africa's bombing of the frontline states in Zimbabwe, in Angola, in Mozambique, and elsewhere. And South Africa also dominated the Southern African Customs Union with Botswana, Swaziland, Lesotho, and Namibia, actually creating, ironically, the common market that had eluded ECOWAS. But it was, of course, a common market that distributed its rewards very unevenly, and South Africa determined how much to pay out in tariffs to all of these countries, and also often prevented their industrialization efforts. So Nigeria at this time then was invited to be a member of the frontline states. It hosted a UN special, a UN conference against apartheid, and headed the UN Special Committee against apartheid for much of its existence. And South Africa was diplomatically isolated and forced to bear the brunt of many of the international community's sanctions. Nigeria was thus the prophet and South Africa the pariah during this period. So we move next to the second period, the second part of this sacred drama with King Babu and the avuncular saint. The Great Expectations was that Nigeria and South Africa, after the end of apartheid and Mandela's election in 1994, would actually create an alliance that would lead Africa. But these were hopes that were soon dashed during this period. And it's important to just focus briefly on the two main protagonists of this particular drama, General Sonny Abacha and Nelson Mandela. You couldn't get a bigger contrast. And the right guy did not win this one. In his 2002 play, King Babu, Nigeria's Nobel laureate and political activist, Wole Soyinka, created one of the most grotesque and absurd figures in world drama. Babu is a bumbling, brainless, brutish buffoon and greedily corrupt military general who exchanges his military uniform for a monarchical robe and a crown. The play is, of course, a thinly disguised satire of Nigeria's General Abacha's debauched rule between September 1993 and his death in June 1998, apparently in the hands of Indian prostitutes in a Viagra-charged session. Abacha was ruthless and reclusive, but hardly as inept as the caricature depicted by Soyinka and many of Nigeria's political opposition. And I think they greatly underestimated him. They didn't expect him to last 5 weeks in power, let alone 5 years. But Abacha was a survivor who knew how to control the Nigerian army and also how to manipulate Nigeria's greedy political class. He played off the West also as a result of Nigeria's oil wealth and also threatening to withdraw peacekeepers from Nigeria, from Liberia and Sierra Leone, knowing full well that many Western countries were not prepared to step into the breach. Mandela, of course, is an iconic figure, a Nobel Prize winner in 1993, one of the greatest moral figures of the 20th century, whose charisma helped South Africa to become not just a normal country after being a pariah, but a country that was expected. And it was quite ironic that under Abacha, South Africa and Nigeria actually traded places from the past, because it was now Nigeria rather than South Africa that was being considered for expulsion from the Commonwealth. It was Nigeria that was facing criticisms for its human rights record, and it was Nigeria that was possibly heading towards civil war. And with Mandela, South Africa was widely considered to be the political and economic success story in Africa. An incident happened which was the nadir of relations between Nigeria and South Africa at this time, which was the hanging of Ken Saro-Wiwa, an environmental activist and a writer, in November 1995. Mandela felt deeply betrayed because he thought he'd got assurances that he wouldn't be hanged. And as soon as it happened, Mandela said he was going to light a fuse under Abacha. And he called on the West to impose sanctions, and he called a SADC meeting where not a single SADC country actually backed Mandela's calls for sanctions. Instead, it was South Africa that was actually being isolated by African countries. Boutros Ghali reminded Mandela of Nigeria's sacrifices in Liberia and Sierra Leone, and South Africa was being depicted as a sort of Western Trojan horse, trying to spread Western interests and values into the rest of Africa. And I think it's important to note here, in trying to understand what South Africa is doing in Zimbabwe and why it adopts a policy of quiet diplomacy, that Mbeki as vice president, and Mbeki had served in Nigeria as head of the ANC between 76 and 78, made a speech in Parliament in May 96 as deputy president, where he warned South Africa not to overestimate its strength and act arrogantly because it didn't have that much leverage over Nigeria. And he also noted that Mandela had been set up for ridicule by the Western countries who quietly continued to pursue their own interests. Warren Christopher, the U.S. Secretary of State in 96, quietly reassured U.S. oil companies that nothing like sanctions would be imposed on Nigeria, while making loud noises criticizing Nigeria. And I think if you're looking for why South Africa behaves as it does in Zimbabwe, this incident was the incident that hurt them the most. It was a watershed. It was deeply traumatic, and never again would they allow themselves to be isolated in African politics, and they would act in concert with others. Anyway, Abacha died. General Abubakar took over. He led a transition in Nigeria that resulted in Obasanjo restoring civilian rule in 1999. And that leads me neatly then to my third and final act of this three-part drama. South Africa's Mbeki and Nigeria's Obasanjo assumed the presidencies of their countries in 1999 at the same time. Both are very different personalities. Mbeki is a pipe-smoking, Sussex-trained economist, and he fancies himself as a sort of intellectual. He writes his own speeches and sees himself as a philosopher king, a sort of prophet of Africa's Renaissance, and widely celebrated as the intellectual father of NEPAD. Obasanjo, in contrast, is a career soldier and engineer who has ghostwritten several biographies, but is widely regarded as more of a practitioner, though he also fancies himself as an intellectual, but I think he's way off the mark. He set up a farm on retirement in 1979. I think Princeton will be a bit more diplomatic than me. I'm not the diplomat. But anyway, it's important to just sketch out very quickly some of what Nigeria and South Africa did during this period. South Africa, of course, struggled at first to establish its credentials in foreign policy, and Mandela was very reluctant to send troops abroad because he said his apartheid army needed to be reformed. And there was quite a bit of distrust within Southern Africa itself, and many of the SADC leaders like Mugabe and Dos Santos and others felt that they were more senior than Mbeki when he came into power. But I think Mbeki eventually did act as a Pied Piper of Pretoria, playing the diplomatic tunes to which warlords, rebels, and soldiers danced in Burundi, DRC, Côte d'Ivoire. And South Africa eventually sent 3,000 troops to Burundi and DRC and was the main peacemaker in Côte d'Ivoire for quite a while. It wasn't always successful, but at least they started to do some of the heavy lifting and invested heavily in peace efforts on the continent. In Zimbabwe, Mbeki worked with leaders from Malawi, Mozambique, Namibia, and Nigeria, but not necessarily on his own. As far as Nigeria was concerned, Obasanjo was also involved in peacemaking efforts in Liberia and Sierra Leone. But Nigeria at this time revealed itself to be practicing hegemony on a shoestring. It actually insisted that the UN take over the Liberia mission after 3 months. And Obasanjo withdrew the bulk of his troops from Sierra Leone as well. So there was a certain multilateralism and a burden sharing that was practiced increasingly by both Nigeria and South Africa because, of course, the UN took over the South African-led mission to Burundi in 2004 as well. A binational commission was set up by both countries in 1999 that has also met about 4 times, and they've discussed issues about the sort of stereotyping of Nigerians as drug traffickers within South Africa itself, trying to create a free trade area between both countries, and also coordinating their policies in the AU, at the UN, etc. But the trade relationship between both countries is also absolutely critical. South African corporates went into South Africa in a big way after 1994, and it was the success of South Africa's mobile telephone network, MTN, which by 2003-2004 was making more money in Nigeria than it was making in South Africa, something like 2.36 billion rand, that convinced other blue-chip South African companies to go into Nigeria. And there's now over $2 billion in trade relations. Nigeria has become the third largest trading partner of South Africa after Mozambique and Zimbabwe. But there were troubles in this marriage of necessity just before Obasanjo and Mbeki left power. And
Mbeki hasn't left yet.
Just before Obasanjo left power. And Mbeki was replaced as head of the ANC in December 2007, I should say. Both of them started looking a bit weak. Obasanjo, after failing in the third term bid in 2006, Mbeki, having been defeated by Jacob Zuma, is basically a lame duck. He's even lamer than George Bush at the moment, it seems. But there were three main issues that resulted in tensions during this time. One was the Security Council seat that both of them were fighting over in 2005. In the end, neither country actually succeeded in getting a seat, but it was a bruising battle in which South Africa was described as too albinocratic, Egypt as too Arab, and Nigeria as too anarchic. But it led to a lot of problems and disputes between them. The second issue was the issue of Côte d'Ivoire, where Obasanjo had appointed Mbeki as the chief mediator. And in the end, Obasanjo and other ECOWAS states eventually pushed him out of that mediation role. And the third issue and area of tension was the binational commission between both countries that did not meet between 2005 and 2007, and Mbeki also opposing Obasanjo's efforts to get a third term as AU chair in Khartoum in 2006. So in concluding, Chair, my final 1 or 2 minutes, it's worth noting that the idea of South Africa and Nigeria as continental leaders is far from universally accepted. The strategic alliance between both countries could come to be seen as a new breed of African imperialism. South Africa's bid for the Olympic Games in 2004 failed in part due to a lack of African support. Nigeria failed to gain African support for its successful UN Security Council bids in 77 and 93 after breaking the rotation rules of the African group. And both countries were also refused a permanent seat with veto power on the African Union's 15-member Peace and Security Council. And during debates on what Africa should do in terms of the Security Council seat, neither South Africa or Nigeria were able to convince other African countries to give up the idea of a veto for an African permanent seat. South Africa and Nigeria will thus have to reassure other African states that their intentions are noble rather than parochial, and both countries will have to consult and make sure they're not trying to dominate the continent or be seen to be doing that in pursuit of parochial interests. And I think only by taking such measures to alleviate these concerns can both countries become the beacons of democracy and engines of economic growth to which their leaders clearly aspire. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Ade. You lived up to your billing. Princeton.
I'm a great admirer of Ade. In fact, his earlier books on the civil wars in West Africa and Sierra Leone, Liberia, were very long on my reading list in my course, on African issues. I kept them on there a little too long. When one of the students gave a report on Liberia and Sierra Leone last year and said, we've got to bring these civil wars to a close. So I've cautioned students about staying up to date. But these books that we're talking about today are exceptional and very important. And I have had the privilege of reading the first chapter of the Nigeria book, and I've read the South Africa one. Let me just focus a little bit more on implications for today and currency. It seems to me there's a couple of parallels between the historical experiences of the two countries coming to right now. In the book, you talk about Nigeria sort of overreaching in the 60s and early 70s and having to retrench, and then doing the same at the end of the 70s and early 80s. And it seems to me that South Africa is at that point perhaps right now, with domestic concerns now looming so large, power shortages, unrest, changes in leadership, et cetera, and that we may be seeing a retrenchment of both countries in terms of foreign policy activism, with Obasanjo and Mbeki both leaving the scene, Yar'Adua not as interested clearly in foreign affairs as Obasanjo was, not asserting himself that way yet at all. And I think there are a lot of implications for that, because even though there's, as you point out, some resentment against hegemons and their sort of claiming leadership, when you look at the structure of the AU, I don't have the figures exactly, but I think it's five countries pay 70% of the dues of the AU. It's a little bit like the UN. And the AU can't survive without strong support for those two countries. And the AU is, in my view, facing quite a bit of crises. I think Darfur and Somalia both have created real qualms within the AU about how active they can be, how much peace and security work they can do. And the Horn seems to be the dilemma for the AU, and it happens to be an area, and you may feel differently, Ade, where neither Nigeria nor South Africa are major players. But I think there are some real implications now and questions about what happens in Africa if both these countries start turning more internal. Not that they can give up their foreign policy roles because they're too big and they're too rich and they're too strong, but they don't become proactive like you said about Obasanjo and Mbeki in this last period with NEPAD and creation of the AU, the G8 Africa Action Plan, all those major initiatives. And the question is what happens elsewhere. There are some other countries coming along very well in Africa, showing both political and economic strength. You have Ghana, you have Tanzania, you have Mozambique. The question is, can they carry the weight in the AU, and particularly can they carry the weight in NEPAD and the ideas of democracy and human rights? And I'm not sure they can. President Kinkwede can take an AU force into the Comoros, but I'm not sure he could mobilize a peacekeeping force in any new conflict from the African Union. So I think there are some serious questions there. Both countries share another dilemma, which you talk about, which is that when they assert themselves on certain issues, like democracy and human rights, they're seen as agents of the West. And they constantly have to watch out and assert themselves in one way or another. And Mbeki does it, I think, more than Obasanjo did. But to say, no, we're really, really very African, and we're not agents of the West. And I'll come back to that. I think South Africa has taken that position even more strongly. Now, let me talk a little about what I see are major dilemmas in South Africa's current foreign policy that I think are going to be serious. First of all, I think South Africa clearly has lost a lot of luster abroad, fairly or unfairly. There was a devastating op-ed about South Africa a couple weeks ago by Michael Gerson in the Post, calling it a rogue democracy that had betrayed its liberation principles. And Fred Hyatt, another Washington Post writer, said, an ever reliable supporter of China and Russia in undermining the responsibility to protect in the UN. Now, you wouldn't have heard this under Mandela, and you wouldn't have heard it a few years ago. It may be unfair because South Africa's policy hasn't been that purely principled from the beginning, but the impression, that moral authority that it had, it seems to me, is slipping away very rapidly. And I think that's going to have an effect on its influence, particularly in the West, particularly in G8 terms, et cetera. But there's another kind of a conflict that I see. Zbigniew Brzezinski, many years ago, when the Soviet Union existed, had an interesting proposition. He said, if a country carries out a foreign policy which is inconsistent with its basic domestic structures, one of two things will happen. The foreign policy will collapse, or the internal structures will change. Now, South Africa has a very strong democracy, has a very strong human rights record, et cetera, but has chosen in international fora, set aside NEPAD for the moment, to focus on what people call sovereign democracy, that is, reform of the international institutions, more vote to the many states, et cetera, and instead of standing for universal human rights, whether it's on Burma or something else. And I wonder how long that can go on without some real conflict growing up inside South Africa or in its foreign policy. To be able to sort of play both sides of the street for a long period of time. The other dilemma, it seems to me, is as you point out, after the embarrassment over Nigeria and the difficulties it's had elsewhere, determined to stay within the African consensus, not to be seen acting alone. And it's an explanation in part for the Zimbabwe policy. But the Africa consensus is breaking down. It's not even uniform in SADC when it comes to Zimbabwe, and it's becoming less uniform elsewhere. We just had Prime Minister Odinga here from Kenya, who spoke out very sharply about Zimbabwe. We've heard it from other leaders as well. And the question is South Africa staying within the African consensus or failing in leadership when the Africans are divided to lead them in a particular direction? And Zimbabwe, even as much as the South Africans hate to hear this, is at least internationally seen as a test of the principles of NEPAD. I know the South Africans hate hearing that, but it seems to people inconsistent if not. One last dilemma on South Africa, and that is that it wants to play in. You have a very nice structure to the Nigeria book, where you talk about the domestic, the near-regional, the Africa-wide, and the international. South Africa wants to be a leader in Africa. It wants to be, for many reasons, a major player in Africa. On the international scene, it plays a somewhat different role. It wants to be an ally of Russia, India, China, Brazil in the North-South debate. And they're not always consistent positions, and it shows up in the trade debate because when you side with India and China, India and Brazil, et cetera, particularly in the Doha round, you're siding with countries that are as close to African markets as anybody in Europe or the United States. And their position in Doha is to make sure their markets stay closed. Now, that's not in Africa's interest. But by bringing the Africans, as South Africa has in many ways, in support of that position, they get to play well on the North-South scene, but I'm not sure they're serving Africa's interests, and I'm not sure how long that will last. The final point, it seems to me, is that if both states are beginning to pull inward and not be able to exert quite the sense of leadership they have before, what doors does this open for external actors in a new way? China in particular, which doesn't necessarily then have to defer to those two countries, but can play one off against the other or in a variety of ways. What does it do for the United States, which, as you point out, has relied heavily on Africans to provide the peacekeeper, and without a partner, we're not very effective in conflict resolution. I think for outsiders, this decline, if I'm right, about activism on the part of the leaders, is going to create real problems and in our policy and in open up opportunities perhaps for others. So let me just leave it there. And again, thank you for your terrific, terrific books.
Got to it. I mean, what is the implication then for the African Union? I mean, how costly will this be to the African Union if there aren't these big drivers who are kind of pushing forward on initiatives? I know you've just come out with the African Union and its institutions, but it seems that much of the African Union's action in the past has had to have a leader who is driving it, and failing that, what are the institutions strong enough to stand without the personal investment of an Obasanjo or an Mbeki and so forth? And then the second one is, the alternative powers. I know it's some ways off, but I think Angola increasingly possibly sees itself as a big engine, economic at least, and perhaps more increasingly political down the line. And there's been some talk within, I think, Angola of playing increasingly that role.
Okay. Thanks, Chair, for getting involved. I thought Princeton's response was really brilliant, and I do want to just tackle some of them because I think he's really framed it in terms of some of the contemporary policy issues. I sort of historicized the debate because I think it's important to understand the context. Yar'Adua, I think, has been surprisingly popular as president in Nigeria, considering the fraudulent way in which he came to power. And he's seen as quite honest, the first Nigerian leader to have actually declared his assets, the first university graduate in a country of such brilliant people, says a lot about the leadership. Although I'm not saying academics necessarily can run countries, they can hardly run university departments. But I think there was a sense in which Obasanjo... Sorry, I know there's some academics here. I know there was a sense in which Obasanjo wanted to be his own foreign minister. You know, he had a very weak foreign minister in the first administration, and even with Olu Adeniji in the second administration, he still got very involved and directed a lot of it. My main worry is more about Yar'Adua's health, how far Yar'Adua is going to survive, and whether he's able to surround himself with enough like-minded people. Because one of the things Obasanjo did, at least for a while, was have some of the reformers, like Ngozi as finance minister, and Soludo, and Ribadu, who were really quite serious in pushing reforms forward before it became more selective and going after political opponents. And whether Yar'Adua is able to do this and actually has a vision and a sense of strategic direction where he wants to take Nigeria, that I'm not sure about, because I'm not sure it's enough just to have someone who's honest and well-intentioned. You need someone who's actually able to implement a vision and have a vision. And after 1 year, it's too early to tell, but at least some of the signs are okay. And I think even in terms of foreign policy, we need to give him a chance to find his feet and see what he may be able to offer. I don't think either Nigeria or South Africa will totally disengage from African peacekeeping efforts. They are still part of the UNAU mission in Darfur. They will still continue to play a role, but I think it will be a role more within the context of the UN, because the logistics and financing simply isn't there to keep maintaining things at that sort of cost. But South Africa, I do think with this recent spate of xenophobia and some of the signs we're seeing, I am quite worried about South Africa, actually, because I don't think that you're going to get a leader who's going to do some of the investments that Mbeki put into Africa. It really was, I mean, a lot of people are criticizing him back, you know, and any stick they can find, they beat him over the head with. But I think historians that are more detached and dispassionate will give him credit for what he's been able to do. He hasn't always achieved, but at least for a while there, we had two leaders who were able to push through a vision and create institutions and give a sense of direction in terms of what to do on Darfur or Sierra Leone or Burundi. And I'm not sure that a future President Zuma is going to do that. I think there is a populist streak about Zuma. There are questions on ethics as well. I believe you call that ethically challenged here in these parts. But I think he is going to be forced by the logic of the situation to look more inwards. But having said that, Zuma was also someone that should be given a lot of credit on Burundi. I mean, he did do a lot of heavy lifting in terms of the mediation there. And even internally, he helped prevent civil war in KwaZulu-Natal, in one of the most volatile areas. But I do think that he's not going to maintain the same sort of sacrifices and commitment that Mbeki did. NEPAD, I think it's important to note, I mean, at some point, NEPAD seemed to be the only game in town, and there was a real buzz about it. And some of the prophets and leaders of NEPAD are now attacking it, like the mercurial President Wad, who is, you know, there was this article about him in the New York Times. You really have to question what Wad is up to. He's very old, I think about 80, which is why you shouldn't vote for McCain. And I think I think he hasn't always made the right decisions and seems a bit erratic. I don't want to say senile. But NEPAD has been quite discredited in the recent past, and it's seen as a South African foreign policy tool. It's based in Midrand in South Africa, and South Africa basically unilaterally picked the last leadership of NEPAD, and it was meant to have been integrated into the African Union in 2006. There's still a lot of foot dragging on that. So I'm not sure how far NEPAD will survive beyond Mbeki, to be quite honest. And it seems to be a program that sticks labels on all sorts of things, but it's not clear how much it's actually delivered. So that's a source of worry. SA losing its luster, I think, is also fascinating. I think South Africa has played not a very good hand on the Security Council. Sometimes they've been right, but I think sometimes you also have to play the politics. You can abstain rather than cast a veto. You know, that's a grown-up way of playing your foreign policy. And I think they've sometimes, you know, overplayed their hand. It's sort of like the delusions of grandeur that you get from new states that are only 14 years old. But I do think, having said that, one has to balance this with the whole glorification of Mandela. I think he deserves all the glorification in terms of reconciliation and how he got South Africa to freedom without a civil war. But you can't have a saint conducting foreign policy. It just simply doesn't work like that. And I think that was the case study that I gave of Nigeria, was ample proof of this. Zimbabwe, I really am not as critical about South Africa as many people are, because I think the key to the solution in Zimbabwe lies in Harare, not in Pretoria. South Africa has to, as a neighbor of Zimbabwe and already hosting maybe over 1 million Zimbabwean refugees, as bad as the situation is there, it could get worse. And so you need a rational policy that can contain the situation and not have it degenerating. And there are issues in Zimbabwe that are unresolved that any new government is going to have to tackle you know, the land issues are real. The fact that the wrong messenger is pushing them does not mean that they're not there. It doesn't mean land wasn't stolen under British colonial rule and put in the hands of a small minority. But this sort of like focus on Mugabe, which the Western media and sections of the South African media enjoy, really does not take us very far. It's just, you know, sort of like the sort of good, bad, ugly type of analysis that the Western media sometimes enjoys on Africa. But I think there are issues there that even a Morgan Tsvangirai regime, if it comes to power, is going to need to address in order to have some sort of stability in the country. So I don't see an alternative to quiet diplomacy. I mean, I've been in the region for 5 years, and nobody has been able to tell me what Mbeki should be doing instead of what he's doing now. Sometimes you hear ludicrous suggestions of, you know, invade, they will fight them, the battle-hardened Zimbabwean army, and 60% of the officer corps of the South African army is still the white officer corps that was destabilizing the rest of the region. And I think it's the worst, quite aside from the fact that it may not succeed, it would be the worst blunder in South Africa. We remember the Lesotho intervention in 98 when they lost their way to the presidential palace and were asking directions. It was a disaster. And I think the South Africans actually have learned from some of those situations. And turning off the electricity also, I'm not sure, is really going to get you the outcome. And I think what Mbeki has tried to do is to sort of drawing from the difficult, bitter experiences with Abacha, trying to make sure he still has an open channel to a recalcitrant dictator. I think Mbeki realizes that Mugabe is bad news, and what he would have preferred is to have a change of leadership within ZANU-PF, but that didn't happen. There was no Polokwane in Zimbabwe. And I think he has actually been able to maneuver Mugabe into a situation where Mugabe actually is probably going to have to lose power or leave in some way. But I think Mbeki in the end will be vindicated, and I don't think he had many options in terms of the hand that he had to play. The WTO also, I think Princeton and my brother there talked about that. I agree with you. Patrick Bond and others have written about the way that South Africa speaks in favor of Africa while not really having a mandate to speak in favor of Africa and cutting all sorts of deals in green rooms that don't necessarily favor Africa's interests. So I think that's absolutely there. And some of the way that South Africa also behaved, you know, in terms of its protectionism of some of its economy, not opening its markets, is also one that's been criticized. France, I agree with you. Rwanda and Zaire were the two incidents that actually changed French policy in Africa. Rwanda, when France had trained and supported the genocidaire and continued to even provide some support, according to Prunier and some of the other scholars, badly damaged French policy. And then Zaire in 1997, when it continued to support Mobutu long after he'd effectively passed his sell-by date, really hurt French policy as well. And I think there are modernizers that appeared in France that started arguing that France needed to adapt a more normal relationship. And I think one of the realities, Herman Cohen, as Assistant Secretary of State, of the US, was also pushing for these Francophone countries to enter agreements with the Bretton Woods institutions. It would have been anathema in the past. And France simply cannot afford its neocolonialism anymore. And so in a very pragmatic way, it started embracing some of the Afro-Saxon countries like Nigeria and South Africa and Ghana and others. But the irony is that France has always historically had a much more lucrative economic relationship with Nigeria than it's had with other Francophone countries combined. But the political relationship is only now catching up. And Chirac visited Nigeria, the first head of state to do so. Babangida Obasanjo visited France, I think, 3 times. So it is a more normal relationship now. Although Sarkozy is a bit of a loose cannon, I think, in terms of what he's been saying about Africa. He's been described as pursuing a foreign policy of Zorro. He's all over the place, effectively. And one just has to see how long this marriage will last also with his French model. The economic partnership agreements. I think the Nigeria and South Africa are absolutely right to resist the economic partnership agreements. And the Africans are so angry about this particular situation because it does look like the old divide and rule tactics, even though Europe says it wants a new relationship with Africa. And Lisbon did not go very well. For both sides. It remains to see how this is going to play out. But the fact some of them have signed up to temporary EPAs is not a positive thing. But I think the Europeans realize how much of a public relations disaster this could be. The African Union, I think, in terms of its institutions, they do need strong leaders and countries like Nigeria, South Africa, Algeria, Ethiopia to move them forward. I don't think that the institutions are strong enough or that it's been institutionalized. There are things like the Peace and Security Council, which has met over 27 times, and it seems to be working quite well. But the Pan-African Parliament and ECOSOC, the civil society vehicle, haven't been as effective. And it's not clear whether the governments want them to be very effective. But there is an AU audit that's been done now, and I would urge all of you to look at it. It's quite an important document that suggests, led by Adebayo Adedeji, that suggests different sorts of reforms that the AU needs to make in terms of how it appoints its commission and how it mobilizes resources for peace and security and rationalizing these sub-regional organizations which have proliferated. And then finally, Chair, your question on Angola. I think there are some countries that we shouldn't forget. The South Africans certainly fear the Angolans because they have oil and they have diamonds. And if they are and a very strong, battle-hardened military that isn't scared to project power to 3 or 4 different theaters. And I think if the Angolans get their act together, they could be a real force. And I think, as China often says, I think it was Akwe that once said this, it's real leverage when you can have a situation when the Americans complain that every time we try to tell off the Angolans on human rights, the Chinese write a check. And I think it's important that countries in Africa, we just did a book on China and Africa, actually not sort of like use China to promote autocrats in Africa, but use it as leverage in bargaining and negotiating with the West. It's very important.
I tend to think that the implication of the xenophobic attacks is more that South Africa has internal problems that it needs to deal with. I think that the attacks come from discrepancies, inequalities in income, unemployment, the fundamental domestic issues, and certain groups were scapegoated for those. But what it does say about South Africa's kind of international role is that it has a whole lot of domestic issues on its plate that are going to preoccupy it for a long time. And I think I don't think anybody here was painting the South Africans as xenophobic by any means, although I leave Ade to...
Yeah, let me speak for myself.
Yeah, but... everybody have a different view. But let's just take a couple more questions, Ade. Gwen.
Okay, my question picks up on some of what you've said, but shifts the focus just slightly to the new book, A Dialogue of the Deaf. Essays on the UN. Given what we've been hearing about this inward focus for both Nigeria and South Africa, I'm wondering what you think that portends for Africa's role at the United Nations over the coming few years. If, in fact, the new leaders are not as concerned about the wholehearted commitment, maybe I'm not reading you right, correct me, the wholehearted commitment to the kind of peace building that they participated in and that the UN made most effective use of, what's going to replace that? And given the role that the ECA played in reshaping governance, whether it was economic or political governance, you know, with the support that Kofi Annan offered, what's going to replace that? And, well, maybe I should just stop there. Yeah.
My name is Max Kelly. I'm from the Henry L. Stimson Center. I have a question that links in somewhat to the question that you just asked, which is also sure to, I think, garner some vehement replies, which is with regard to the AFRICOM proposal that has clearly gone over like a lead balloon. The question is not specifically about AFRICOM, but actually about the there are a number of programs of which AFRICOM was one and initiated by various nations to try and build African and in some cases AU security architecture and security capacity. In part, you know, things like the Global Peace Operations Initiative of the U.S., the new French Peacekeeping Training Initiative, were designed, you know, were aimed more at building AU security capacity for missions like UNAMID, etc. AFRICOM obviously would have partially dealt with that and also partially counterterror, etc. My question broadly is, given that AFRICOM has gone over like a lead balloon and given what you're talking about in terms of the relative withdrawal of Nigeria and South Africa from these roles or from playing such strong roles, how much receptivity or even if the offers are coming through, again, through the GPOI or through the new French program, is there much? Are there nations on the other side, perhaps other than South Africa and Nigeria, who are interested in engaging with those kinds of programs in order to better take on missions like, well, do better in places like Darfur or Somalia, or et cetera? Thank you.
We're going to go over a little bit.
The advantage, you see, Chair, of taking too many questions is that one can avoid some of them. Okay, very, very good questions. Libya's role in Africa. I think Gaddafi played a very important role in ensuring that the AU was born and created. And he hosted a lot of meetings in Sirte. He actually apparently wanted the new AU to be located in Libya. And he paid off the debts also of various African countries to the OAU at the time in order to be able to buy himself influence there. And Mbeki and Obasanjo and others actually had to react to make sure that they shaped a more gradualist AU rather than one that was unrealistic, pushing for monetary union and more federalist, of which Gaddafi would be president. So he deserves credit for what he's done, although many people have pointed out that part of this was his isolation and sense of betrayal on the part of the Arabs after the Lockerbie issue with Britain and the US, and then taking off his pan-Arab robes to don pan-African robes as well. Some people see it as a bit opportunistic, but he does deserve credit for pushing the vision of the African Union and putting some resources behind it. In terms of the Zimbabwe from the former British diplomat, I'm glad you revealed your interest in this. I don't actually think that if you had a Zuma presidency or a Mandela presidency, Zimbabwe would be resolved by now. I think it's a total illusion to imagine that. And it completely overestimates South Africa's capacity to actually control somebody like Mugabe. And I don't think the sort of leverage you're talking about actually exists. It's easy for COSATU and Zuma and others to make noise when they don't have to make decisions. Obviously, you can say whatever you want when you're an armchair critic. But when you're actually faced with the realities of power and the fact that a very bad situation could actually turn worse, because, you know, if civil war does erupt in Zimbabwe or instability, the refugees are going to flow into South Africa. They won't go to Britain. So it's easy for Blair and Brown to make noise because they won't go to Britain. But when you're a neighboring country, I think you have to do what you can responsibly to contain the situation. And I don't believe that having a different government there would have produced a different result, because the main player in this is Mugabe himself and not the South Africans. So in my view, I think you totally overestimate the leverage of South Africa. The French policy, I don't think we're saying something that's very different. I think it's both political and economic. And that was my point about the Bretton Woods institutions. The devaluation of the CFA franc in 94 was absolutely critical, as you said, because the Francophone countries really did feel a sense of betrayal and realized at that point that they were being let loose. But I do think it's important to note that Nigeria and France have always had a very strong commercial, even during the, just after the Civil War, when France had supported secessionists against the federal Nigeria. Nigeria has always been around the third largest trade partner of France in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's not something that is new. But I do think what France is going to do is maintain its economic relations in countries like Gabon and Cameroon and Congo-Brazzaville that have oil, as well as your Nigeria and South Africa, and focus a lot less on the others. But don't forget, France has military bases in Senegal, in Côte d'Ivoire, in Djibouti, and had in Central African Republic also. So you can never discount the military dimensions of French policy in Africa, and the interventionism has always been a very strong part of that. ZANU-PF and some of those issues that we talk about, I think land is an issue, Akwe, and my own understanding of the civil war in Zimbabwe that was fought between 65 and 1980 was a large part of what they were fighting for was land. So to dismiss it as blithely as you do, I think is actually a historical to quite a large extent. Mugabe is clearly manipulating the land issue for his own political survival and his own political ends, but it doesn't mean that land isn't an important issue. In a largely agricultural country, don't forget it's not South Africa, which has more industry. Land is an important issue in a country where people are landless and unemployed, and the sorts of resources you would need in a post-conflict, almost post-conflict peace-building situation in Zimbabwe is enormous, and nobody is really prepared to provide those sorts of resources. But again, I think, you know, the further away you are from the Zimbabwe situation, the more flawed your analysis tends to be. And the one thing I've learned from being in the region is that nobody knows quite what to do about Zimbabwe. And I don't think there are any easy answers in this particular situation. But I would not say that the land issue is not one that Imorgan Tsvangirai or anybody that takes over power would not have to give priority to. And I think Odinga, I didn't come to listen to him, himself is the beneficiary of an elite pact that is a shame to Africa. So he's hardly one to talk. People in glass houses should not throw stones, because Kenya represents an elite pact, a fraudulent elite pact, because if you can rig elections in Africa and then the elites arrange some sort of government to loot, I don't think we're going to really go very far on the continent. So those of you who see Raila as a hero, I see Kenya as the next conflict prevention case in Africa. And all of you policy wonks in Washington that are serious about conflict prevention should really be looking at Kenya. Chair, I think you need to stay neutral. My sister from South Africa, I have to disagree with you. Nobody knows the number of undocumented migrants in South Africa. So your 9 million figure is not one that comes from any reliable source. The Southern African Migration Project and others are not sure. And there was a Human Sciences Research Council project in 2001 that claimed a few years ago that there were 3.5 to 4.1 million migrants. But that was discredited by a lot of scholars because it was based on one neighborhood in Gauteng that then extrapolated, but it was methodologically flawed in terms of how it was done. So nobody is sure about whether there are 3 million Zimbabweans. It's a figure that's thrown around, but there is no reliable source for it, and no research has been done that everybody agrees on. There are quite a few, but I'm not sure we're sure about the figures. And you say there's not much xenophobia, and you know the way that the South Africans have tried to portray this, it's like poor people killing poor people, and you know there's a third force, and that kind of absorbs people, doesn't it? Because if it's a third force, then you know we're okay. Nobody is responsible in a way. But I think you need to look at the figures. 600,000 people expelled from South Africa between 1994 and 2000. 177,000. These are figures from Human Rights Watch, the Southern African Migration Projects. 177,000 Zimbabweans expelled between 2005 and 2006. In a poll in 2001 that was done by the Southern African Migration Project, it showed that 85% of South Africans polled thought that migrants should be denied their freedom of speech. 60 to 65% of them thought that they should be denied police protection and access to social services. So across the board in South Africa, xenophobia is rife, both in terms of class, income levels, race, all sorts of things. And I think you've had cases of police actually destroying documents of undocumented people. The Lindela detention camp is notorious, and Human Rights Watch has reported that there have been deaths there. There have been torture. The Nigerian government has complained officially about the treatment of Nigerians there. And I think your elite have also, not all of them, of course, a lot of people have written very sensibly. People came out and condemned this violence. Tutu went, Winnie Mandela went, etc. So I think most people are obviously not xenophobic. But I think your elite have sometimes buried their heads in the sand, ostrich style, and have not taken proper responsibility for some of the xenophobia that exists. They create some of the permissive environment that allows xenophobia to thrive. And at Ditchley Park, Princeton and Jennifer may remember, we had very senior South Africans there, some of your greatest thinkers, saying things like, you know, South Africa doesn't owe the rest of the continent anything, and linking crime to foreigners and things like that. So I think some of those issues need to be addressed. I said this recently, and I got criticized for it, but, you know, Nigerians are loud and brash and arrogant like Americans, and they will speak their mind no matter what.
I'm not censoring you, but...
Chair, do you want me to finish answering the questions?
Yeah, just very briefly, rapidly.
Am I talking too much?
Well, we've gone over time a bit, is the thing.
I thought you said you'd allow us to do that. Okay, so the UN question, Gwen, we can talk about it afterwards, but basically, I think that's why the Africans are trying to get a permanent seat on the Security Council, because Africa's stock is so low now. We don't send the best diplomats to the UN anymore. Within the Secretariat of the UN, there aren't that many strong Africans in senior positions anymore, and those need to be taken care of. Then my friend and brother on the ACRI and Dakota, these are not initiatives that really do a lot. You know, logistics and finance are the main things that African armies are calling for, not $20 million a year programs or programs that are going to sort of turn the relationship between Africa and America into a militarized one, where anti-terrorism replaces anti-communism in terms of U.S. priorities. So I think that's really the main perception problem there. I haven't answered the food security question of the intern, which is bad, because I think we should take interns seriously. But my brother, I think Nigeria and South Africa can play a role as agricultural exporters and in actually setting an example for regional efforts to establish food security. Some of it is already going on within SADC.
Lost control of the situation. Princeton, would you like to say anything to wrap up?
Very briefly, I think one of the things that I think from a U.S. And perhaps G8 point of view is the absolute need to have good, credible, strong African interlocutors. Obasanjo and Mbeki played that role for several years, and they had credibility both because of their democratic credentials and because of their leadership on NEPAD and all of that, and the power they brought to the table. Obasanjo got tarred by his third term issue, and Mbeki's losing some of that. And setting aside whether one could change things in Zimbabwe, image counts. We learned that painfully in the United States in the last 7 years. Image counts. When you lose your image, you lose your allies, you lose your influence, you lose your friends. The fact that South Africa never comes out and says the killing of people by this government in Zimbabwe is horrendous loses image. You can have 100 reasons why Mbeki doesn't say it, but you don't hear a strong condemnation.
Zuma,
but I'm not talking about Zuma. I'm talking about image. And image, you may have to pay a price on image for all the reasons, but image counts. And with Nigeria and South Africa losing image, I worry about this whole dialogue. There's a whole range of issues we haven't talked about in which you need strong African role. Climate change and its whole relationship to Africa, where it's going to have enormous – talk about migration. All the predictions on climate change say that it is going to produce millions and millions more migrants in Africa. Nuclear proliferation, South Africa's role, its interest in nuclear power, what kind of precedents it sets vis-a-vis how we treat Iran. There are a lot of issues there, and if we don't have good, strong, credible interlocutors on the African side, I fear that U.S.-Africa policy is going to get very diffuse, looking all over the continent for this person, that person, et cetera, but not having the kind of interlocutors that will lead to the kind of, I think, reasonable progress that was made over the last few years. Thanks.
Thank you for just an excellent session. I enjoyed it for the most part. Thank you, Ade. And,